the headlines. The European Council call on EU leaders to speed up talks on use of confiscated Russian assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine. Brazil and Argentina announce a plan to develop a common currency in order to reduce the two countries' reliance on the US dollar. And U.S. police say a man who shot dead 10 people in the state of California killed himself after hours of manhunt. Welcome. Our top story, the European Council has called on EU leaders to speed up talks on the use of confiscated Russian assets for the reconstruction of Ukraine. President Charles Michel says the profits from the frozen assets could be used for reconstruction efforts. Michel described the proposal as a question of justice. The EU has blocked 300 billion euros of assets belonging to the Russian Central Bank back in November. The move is part of the sanctions the bloc imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Moscow has hit back with its own measures, including limitations to supply of energy to Europe. Germany says it is ready to authorize Poland to send German-made Leopard tanks to help Ukraine in its fight against Russian forces if Warsaw makes such a request. Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said Berlin will not stand in the way if it is asked the question. She said Germany is also discussing with its partners whether to supply those tanks. Meanwhile, the French president did not rule out the possibility of supplying Kiev with the Leclerc tanks. Emmanuel Macron said, however, that sending tanks must not escalate the situation. New developments come as Western nations remain divided over supplying Ukraine with the main battle tanks that it has requested. Germany had linked its stance on the Leopards to U.S. reluctance to transfer its own Abrams tanks. Now, Russia has repeatedly warned that the West's military aid to Ukraine will only prolong the war. And almost 1 year into the war in Ukraine, there seems to be no diplomatic solution to the deadly conflict. The situation is exacerbating even further, given the rift among the Western countries on how to assist Kiev militarily. The question is if such divisions would grow considerably and finally lead to a bigger confrontation.
Fractures are appearing in the Ukraine conflict between the Western backers of the war, first amongst themselves, then with Ukraine. Even though some 50 nations agreed to provide Kyiv with billions of dollars worth of military hardware, including armored vehicle and munitions needed to push back Russian forces, Germany has refused to provide Ukraine with Leopard tanks. Not only that, it has prevented other nations from transferring these tanks to Ukraine by countries that have them in their possession. The new German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said that despite heightened expectations, we still cannot say when a decision will be taken and what the decision will be when it comes to the Leopard tanks. This has angered Ukraine, which blasted the global indecision of its allies after Germany's refusal. A Ukrainian presidential advisor tweeted, "Today's indecision is killing more of our people. Every day of delay is the death of Ukrainians. Think faster." It appears that the main disagreement lies between the U.S. and Germany, which has indicated that it would agree to do so only if the U.S. provided its Abrams tanks as well. Washington has said providing its Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. This disagreement has led to friction within the circle of U.S. congressmen. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has called on both countries to supply the machines. To the Germans, he said send the tanks to Ukraine because they need them. It is in your national interest that Russian President Vladimir Putin loses in Ukraine. to the U.S. President Joe Biden administration. He said send American tanks so that others will follow our lead.
So the growing division among countries in the West brings to the spotlight the fact that each and every one of those countries are seeking their own political agenda by arming Kiev. And if that's the case, would people in Ukraine finally get to realize that their country is being used as an instrument for other nations' anti-Russia goals?
Military assistance to Ukraine has continued unabated in recent weeks and months. The headline reads, Europe is gearing up to send Western tanks to Ukraine. It almost sounds like the warring parties are just getting warmed up to the conflict, that the war has entered a new phase. One conclusion could be that Ukraine is losing the war on the ground since it continues to seek more military assistance, and what it has received so far has not been enough to defeat the Russian forces. This, however, will not deter NATO and a number of individual member states who have pledged to provide heavier weapons to Ukraine. U.S.'s cautious stance may be that it does not want to fall into a direct conflict with Russia. That could also mean that it may risk defeat, or that this risks getting into a nuclear confrontation. Russia's reaction to countries that are going to provide Ukraine with tanks was a warning. Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, has said Kiev's foreign backers do not care about Ukrainian lives and are motivated by their desire to hurt Russia. Those tanks can burn and will burn like the rest of the weapons. The nations supplying them are using Ukraine as an instrument in achieving their anti-Russian goals. Russia has also stated that this is no longer a war between Russia and Ukraine, but a war between Russia and US and NATO. But what the Ukrainian defense minister said has been very telling. He tweeted recently, "We are carrying out NATO's mission today. They aren't shedding their blood. We are shedding ours. That's why they are required to supply us with weapons." All that brings everyone to the question, when will Ukrainians realize their country is being sacrificed for the sake of the US weakening Russia?
Elsewhere, high school students in the Italian capital, Rome, have held a rally against the country's school system. The demonstration was held on the first anniversary of the death of a school student who lost his life during an internship. Max Civili has filed a report.
Hundreds of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they called a school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
For a long time, our schools have abdicated their responsibility for a broad education, replacing it with convenience. Schools today churn out workers ready to join a labor market in which exploitation is the norm. In addition to that, educational standards are becoming increasingly poor.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Moving on, Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including a common currency which would wean off reliance on the US dollar in bilateral transactions. Brazil's President Lula da Silva and his Argentine counterpart Alberto Fernandez made the revelation in a joint article they penned. The text says Brasilia and Buenos Aires want to eliminate barriers to their exchanges and encourage the use of local currencies. The two countries have also decided to speed up discussions on a common South American currency aimed at boosting regional trade. Now, Lula had brought up the idea of a common currency during his presidential campaign. He has chosen Argentina for his first trip abroad since he took office. Relations between Brasilia and Buenos Aires were tense during Brazil's former right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro. Meanwhile, Brazil's new president has accused his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, of committing genocide against the indigenous people of the Amazon region amid public outrage over humanitarian catastrophe there. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says Bolsonaro's far-right administration is responsible for the crisis. Lula says the previous administration encouraged the 20,000 illegal miners who flooded the region during his term and caused death and destruction. The president says Bolsonaro just abandoned the Yanomami people. Lula made the remarks after a visit to the Amazon. Reports say children in the region are dying of malnutrition and diseases caused by poisoning due to gold mining. Now, Bolsonaro denies responsibility despite criticism of his environmental policies that led to a 60% rise in Amazon deforestation. A man who went on a shooting rampage and killed 10 people during the Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations in the U.S. state of California has been found dead. Police say they found the body of the shooter after hours of manhunt. They said the suspect, identified as 72-year-old Hu Can Tran, died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His body was inside a van in a city about 35 kilometers away from the site of the shooting in Monterey Park, which is home to a large Asian community. An investigation is still underway to determine the motive behind the carnage. The incident, which also injured 10 people, is the latest in the grim litany of mass shootings in the U.S. Over the past years, there have been growing calls for passing stricter legislation on gun control and curtailing access to weapons in the country. Staying in the United States, where Joe Biden has now reached 2 years in office and his approval rating has never been lower. The first part of his term has been defined by constant crises, and many speculate he won't be able to run for re-election. Rami Mazahari reports from Chicago.
United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term. And perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is, it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right, they take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
That brings an end to our international bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. winter is surely the best time to visit south of Iran. Just imagine, in about an hour and a half, you can take a trip from the snowy capital city of Tehran to southern Iran with the mild weather up above 20 degrees Celsius. It's interesting, isn't it? Iran is a four-season country, which besides its touristic and historical attractions, has become a privileged site to live and visit. By the way, I'm on a flight to the port city of Bandar Abbas, southern Iran, and we're going to have a marine adventure today. Guess what? Our main destination is the southernmost island of Iran in the Persian Gulf. Yes, Bumus Island. I guess it would be one of my attractive trips ever.
Ladies and gentlemen, flight number 834 will land at Bandar Abbas International Airport in a few moments. Please stay seated and fasten your seatbelt.
Okay, we are about to arrive. The Persian Gulf has always been attractive to me. I have a very special feeling about it. It's the honor and pride of Iranians.
Can I sit for landing?
Welcome to Bandar Abbas International Airport. Local time is 9:46 a.m. and the outside temperature is 18 degrees Celsius. For your safety, please remain seated with the seatbelt fastened until the aircraft comes to a complete stop and main doors are open.
Wow! Did you hear that? 18 degrees Celsius! This morning I was freezing at the airport in Tehran.
On behalf of the captain and the crew, we hope you an enjoyable stay in Bandar Abbas.
Iran lies along the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, and it possesses dozens of islands there. Three of the most strategic ones are the Greater and Lesser Tombs, as well as Bumusa, which have been always part of Iran throughout its long history. A look at history indicates that the sovereignty of Iran over these islands have been recorded in many books, historical documents, maritime journals, geographical maps, official documents, and administrative reports. The Persian Gulf is home to many other islands. Geographically, the biggest island in the Persian Gulf is Qeshm Island, located in the Strait of Hormuz. The Persian Gulf is now considered as the energy hub of the world. Close to 20 million barrels of crude and condensates are shipped from the Persian Gulf and through the strategic Strait of Hormuz per day, with the normal global oil consumption amounting to about 100 million BPD. That means almost a fifth of the world demand passes through the strategic strait. About 50,000 ships navigate through the waterway annually, of which 17,000 are oil tankers that head to Asian countries.
Passengers of flight number 549 for Shiraz are requested to proceed to gate number 5 for boarding.
Well, I am now at the airport. I have to take a taxi to Shahid Haqqani Pier. A maritime route has recently been established from this pier to Bumusa Island. Though I could take a plane to the island directly from Tehran, I preferred to experience a marine adventure.
Passengers of flight number 754 for Bumusa are requested to proceed to gate number 4 for boarding.
A marine trip is more attractive. Shahid Haqqani Pier. Thank you. The distance between Shahid Haqqani Port to Bumusa Island is 110 nautical miles. On our way to Bumusa Island, we pass by the Persian Gulf islands of Qeshm, Hormuz, Larak, Hengam, Lesser Tomb, and the Greater Tomb. I mean, we have to pass by all these islands in order to reach the southernmost island of Iran. Thank you. And here's Shahid Haqqani Pier. It's interesting to note that here is one of the big cargo and passenger piers, a point by which people travel to the surrounding islands or even countries by ship, boat or launch. Well, I had bought my ticket earlier. Wow, what a beautiful ship. Big crowd of tourists are here. Thank you. About to set off. I'm really excited. Can you hear the seagulls? Listen. Oh, there is sound which is combined by the sea waves. It's really relaxing. And here we go. I prefer to be on the deck. Actually, I don't want to miss any scene in the Persian Gulf. Colors. You may not believe, but the Persian Gulf looks like a picture, a painting. Oh, it's great. Thank God I brought my camera. Let me take a picture. Heading toward the south. On the left, there is Hormuz Island, and on our way ahead, there is Esh Island. I can almost see Hormuz Island. This island is famous for its red soil. Geological minerals of this island are very famous. And look at there. It's Esh Island. And on the left, there is Larak Island. Yes, it is. We have to pass between these two islands. Esh Island is so big. It's unique, attracting many visitors. This island has placed a collection of rock and sand coasts in itself. So clean that the island is clearly visible from here. The vastness of its historical, cultural, and archaeological sites along its precious geological heritage has made this island the only geopark of the West Asia region. There. On the right, it must be Hengam Island. Yes, it is. If you're interested in dolphins, pay a visit there. It's really unique. Well, let me take some photos. These places must be recorded. Thank you. we're close to Bumusa Island. I'm so eager to see the southernmost island of Iran. But before reaching the island, I can see two other strategic islands. Guess what? Yes, they are the Greater Tomb and the Lesser Tomb. It's a great feeling to be here. Being at the heart of the Persian Gulf. Seeing the islands, which are Iranian and have really unique flora and fauna. We're about to reach. The sea is so clear at the shore of this island. Therefore, I can easily see the corals and the fish. I can't wait to see them from a closer view. This island has spectacular shoreline landscapes because of being located along the route of migrating birds, especially during winter. Well, we are now at Bumusa Pier, on the eastern coast of the island, and we have to get off the ship. To be here. The weather is so pleasant. Wow, it's great. I have to take a taxi to get to the northwestern part of the island. I mean, Dowlat Park. In Dowlat Park, you can see swallows, larks, eagles, as well as turtles beside sand hills and salt-tolerant plants. Around the island, there is a vehicular road which is named the Persian Gulf. It doesn't take much time to get to the park. Well, I am now at the seashore. There are migrating birds as far as the eye can see. Listen. Amazing, isn't it? Oh, and watching the sunset of this island is a must, in my opinion. I've heard that people come here to find serenity after a long, busy work day. Oh, it's very dreamy. And different facilities are available here for the local residents, from hospital to school and commercial centers. And what are seen from this point are the beautiful minarets of the Jame Mosque of Bumusa. I don't think it's very far from here. For noon prayers, and people are heading to the mosque. The Jame Mosque of Bumusa, with its azure dome, is shining like a beautiful gem in this island. Thank God, today was one of my best traveling experiences.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another mass shooting in the U.S. 10 people have been killed in L.A. near a Chinese lunar celebration event. What has become a staple of life in America, it appears. And the question still remains, why does America tolerate mass shootings that are taking place due to firearm possessions? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this recurring crisis there and what role the gun lobby, the NRA, has, along with why U.S. politicians and the U.S. president himself have failed to stop this phenomenon. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Richard Becker, an anti-war activist from Answer Coalition, joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, who joins us from New York. Welcome to you both. Another sad day for the U.S. when it comes to mass shootings there, Richard Becker. 10 dead in gun violence near the Chinese Lunar Year celebrations. And the way that this was described was a shooter with a machine gun carrying a large number of rounds, or carrying a number of rounds of ammunition so that he could reload, is what how he was sighted during action. What is your initial reaction to this?
Well, it's horrific. It's just horrific. And, you know, we've seen the mass killings now in Uvalde, in Buffalo, very near where I was from originally, but all over the country. And it's true that I think there's been 30 already in this year, in 2023, and you know, it's a you also have to think when we hear this is the latest reports and we see these terrible casualties and the injuries of those who survive, life changing injuries in many cases. And you know, immediately what I was thinking today was thinking back to 2005 when George W. Bush passed a law that was called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And what it did was basically say that the arms makers are exempt. They are protected by the federal government from being having any responsibility for what their products are used for. And there's no doubt that they know what their products are being used for, because the huge number of weapons that are being produced and sold inside of the United States are bound to end in like what we've seen again today. And the U.S. government has protected, it has carved out protections. It is carved out protections for the arms makers. It's carved out protection from criminal liability or going to jail for any of those responsible for the opioid crisis. It protects the rich and the big corporate interests, and then says that, you know, the leaders come back and talk about, you know, people are, who have suffered these losses and these tragedies are in our thoughts and prayers. I mean, it's the cynicism is incredible.
Okay, since you talked about the number of arms being produced or guns being produced, I have to then go to that stat, because stats speak for themselves. So, Margaret Kimberly, the gun ownership in the U.S., it says, based on the latest, that the U.S. ratio of 120.5 firearms per 100 residents, which is up from 88 per 100 in the year from the year 2011. But then more interestingly was when the NRA, based on a simple Google search, which is that National Rifle Association, in information related to that, it said that the number of privately owned firearms has more than doubled from about 192 million to more than 405 million. 405 million, including more than 167 million handguns. Okay, so there's money in it, there's profits that are being made, but the fact that these gun manufacturers are exempt from accountability, they have to be protected. Are we looking at the NRA being that modem or that channel for their protection?
Well, you know, they're not the only corporate interests that are protected from any liability. Vaccine makers are protected from liability. Airlines have great protection from liability. They don't even have to protect the country when they don't schedule flights and cancel flights. So it's part of what's happening in this country where corporate interests are in control. We have an oligarchy in this country, so it could be the NRA, it could be Big Pharma, it could be any number of entities. But the big problem here goes back to the beginnings of American history. This is a settler colonial state, and this mentality that this is a country to be conquered, that other people are to be subjugated, is one that still resonates with millions of people. I also think that as this country is a failed state, that is the hard truth of the matter, as conditions, living conditions for people deteriorate, as people become more and more insecure economically, I believe those people who are frail psychologically are inspired to act on their worst impulses. And I think every incident leads to another. These people who need help inspire one another. So when there's one mass shooting, another generally follows fairly quickly. And so I think this combination of this mentality that says it's okay to be violent, it's beneficial to be violent, and you can't separate the domestic from the international. You can't have a country with a huge military budget which claims the right to kill people all around the world. You cannot be surprised when individuals feel like they have the right to kill when they want to.
Okay. I'm interested in your, you mentioned psychological problems. I'm interested as to why you chose that to being one of the factors for what you just said.
Well, I think it's obvious. There are people, many people in this country who are just unhinged, who are it's not a technical term, who are out of their minds. And I think the combination of the deterioration in life, for example, there are fewer and fewer living wage jobs. The safety net that we have is always threatened. People can't count on work. They can't count on having the ability to care for themselves. There's more and more insecurity. And I think when you combine that with people who, I mean, and they always exist, do they not? People who need mental health care. And then you combine that with this country that's historically been very violent and where the political system protects this type of violence and others. These people now are, I believe, inspired. And when you don't handle it, when there was no crackdown, then, of course, each one inspires the next.
All right. So let's dive into that issue, if we can, because it's pretty shocking, Richard Becker, what our guests there touched on when it comes to the number of deaths overall, which needs to be mentioned here. We're looking at 40,000, roughly, or between 40 to 45,000 that are dying every year in the U.S. because of firearms in one form or another, which translates into more than 110 Americans that die every day, okay? But what's very shocking and at the same time very interesting, but more shocking than that, is with the breakdown. When you take a look at the breakdown, you have a little over 19,000 based on the homicides that happen, but 24,000, which is more than homicides, is because of suicides. That's pretty shocking. I mean, I don't know if many people are aware of that. They know that U.S. is a dangerous place, and of course, firearms is a problem that the U.S. has, but not many people, I think, are aware that it's because of suicides. Are the reasons given, first of all, what do you think of that? Are the reasons given there by our guest, Margaret, reasons for people to take their lives? And what does that say about the state of mental health of many Americans in the U.S.?
Well, yes, I completely agree with what Ms. Kimberly said. And the, you know, we live in a very atomized society. People are on their own. And if you're lucky and, you know, you have a good income and, you know, your family has stability and so forth, you know, still you can run into a lot of problems. But if you don't have those things, and particularly if you don't have income, if you become...
Richard Becker, I think we lost you. Okay, let me go to you, Margaret Kimberly. Margaret Kimberly, we were talking about this shocking stat about the suicides, which you touched on. Now, based on what we're looking at, there are pros and cons on this. Advocates for these stricter gun laws say that, you know, you need to have lawmakers devoting some resources for people in order to prevent them from taking their lives with firearms. At the same time, you have gun control opponents who have framed the gun violence as a symptom of a broader mental health problem, which obviously shows that there's a crisis there, and it's not the life being taken away is not due to the firearm, it's due to the person. What would you say to them?
Well, I think it's both. You know, we have these... people have easy access to these guns with large magazines, which can fire many bullets, which no one, I believe, has any reason to own. There's no reason. These are military grade weapons, and anyone can get their hands on them when there's no justification for it. Now, the opponents of gun control will say that they may be a marksman or it's target shooting or hunting. I don't understand why, though, these cannot be regulated. But the NRA, an organization I do not support at all, has a lot of support around the country. So I think it's a combination of two things. The statistic you gave about how many gun fatalities are caused by suicides is a huge number.
Right.
And I think to the point I was making before, that's something that isn't talked about very much, the suicides that happen with guns. But as the other guest said, we have this atomized society, people on their own, worsening economic conditions, a political system that does not address the needs of the people, but only addresses the needs of the oligarchy. All of these things combine to create a kind of thinking among millions of people, people who see other people as their enemy, people who don't see any common cause with others, and then may have... mental health problem. And then, of course, when it's not taken care of, when nothing changes, each act inspires the next one. So I hate to say this, but it's inevitable that we're going to have these mass shootings until something changes. But we live in a society where the system doesn't help the people in so many other ways, so we should not be surprised about this either.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we have Richard Becker back with us also. Richard Becker, when you had that school shooting that happened in Texas that left 19 children dead and two adults also as part of that, basically 21 people to have been killed, it was very, how can I say, it's very telling what the U.S. President Joe Biden said when he said, or posed as a question when he said, when are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? What does that say about the gun lobby?
Well, the gun lobby is quite powerful. I mean, many, many politicians have received $1 million or multi-million dollar donations over the years. Mitt Romney, who's considered one of the moderate Republicans, I think is the leader with more than $13 million in donations from the gun lobby. And, it's very true that the huge number of weapons are already dispersed in the population. And in order to begin to halt this, there has to be consequences for the gun makers. And there haven't been. When the opioid makers like Purdue Pharmacy would send a million opioid pills to a town of 300 people, they didn't think that, somehow those were all going to be used for pain purposes, or that there were going to be those kind of health problems in that town that required that number. No, they knew that this was going to go into the illegal market, to the black market, and become immensely powerful and immensely profitable. And it did. And the same thing goes for the weapons makers. They know that these guns that are being distributed in such vast quantities throughout the United States and such an increase in the number of guns in circulation domestically, that that's going to mean more mass shootings, more mass killings, but they are protected. They are protected the same way that Margaret Kimberly mentioned, so many other industries are, so many other capitalist industries are.
Okay, the question of accessibility is very important over here.